speak with you. Our topic today is a sort of a continuum from our previous topic, but really moving in significant fast forward. Last time we talked about Nishtana Teva, issues in science in the past, antiquated notions like the 8-month baby, like the spontaneous generation. We are now going to shift our eyes not only to the present, but to the near future, and see what the ideas of science have had in store for us in the 21st century. And really this is, to some extent, very much so contemporary halacha, and to some extent thought experiment, anticipating the near future and what the halachic issues may be. In a certain sense, this year is devoted to the topics which some of you in this classroom may write articles for the Journal of Contemporary Halacha, but haven't yet been written and are awaiting to be written by the likes of yourselves. Now, I want to begin with this Mishnah from Pirkei Avos, and the reason I begin with this is because, as opposed to many of your other shiurim, which are entirely halachic sources, many of the sources we're going to be talking about today are scientific sources. And in that vein, I bring you this Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, which states, "Reb Shimon Omer Amahalech Baderech Veshone Umafsik Mimishna So the Omer Manoa Ilan Zeh Umanoa Nir Zeh Malo Alakosuv Kilu Mischai Benafsho." So the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos, the person is in the middle of learning, he's got his shas in his hand, and he's walking the streets, and he sees a tree, he sees a magnificent tree like this, and he says, "Manoa Ilan Zeh." How magnificent is this tree? So what does the Mishnah say? The Mishnah says, he's guilty of a capital crime. So what capital crime is this man committed? So the pashtus is that you should be learning 24 hours a day. You shouldn't be wasting your time lifting your head up from the sefer and looking at the tree. But I heard from Rabbi Fold, and also written by Rav Shimshon of Fol Hirsch, a beautiful idea which very much relates to the Torah Mada philosophy and directly to our shir today. And the key word here is umafsik mimishnaso. In your midst of learning, and you take a look at this tree and you pause, and you separate yourself from your learning, and then you ogle at the beauty of nature, and you say, nature is one thing, the godless of this tree is one thing, and what I learned, the Gemara that I learned, the Rishonim that I learned, is a separate entity, and the two are not to be linked, harei umischai benafsha. Because when you look at this tree, and I have the pasuk also, ki odom eitz hasadeh, not only the tree, but the metaphorical tree. You study anatomy, you study physiology, you study pathology, and you don't appreciate that this is too from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and this itself is learning, as the Rambam very much said on many occasions, that when you study science, you study medicine, you are studying HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the world of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and gaining appreciation of the godless of Barei. If you don't appreciate that, you've missed the point in Arei Lemischai Benafsha. So in that vein today, many of the things we're going to be discussing are issues of science and the medicine. And you will see it's really godless habore, extraordinary advances that we've been privy to in our lifetimes and the ones that we will see in short order. And I know and I'm confident that you will be amazed by some of the things you're about to hear over the next short period of time. In the same vein, just to, apropos the, we happen to find ourselves in the holiday of Hanukkah, so I heard Rabbi Willig, he gave a Thanksgiving, Kollel Thanksgiving in the Five Towns, and I had the bliss of hearing Rabbi Willig. And at the end, he mentioned this beautiful idea about B'nai Bina Yimei Shmona from Moos Tzur. And he said, B'nai Bina, our Bina is Mevin Dover Mitoch Dover. So he said, why is it that it says B'nai Bina and Yimei Shmona? Because B'nai Bina, Kavushir Anani. What's the superfluous phrase of Yimei Shmona? So he said, what do the B'nai Bina understand? And the B'nai Bina understand that not only are the 7 days of the Nes Chanukah a Nes, but even the first day, the very fact that you can take today a match, strike a match, light a piece of cotton, connect it to some oil, and that can burn, which many of us would think is just mere nature, even that is godless habore. Even the very nature that we consider, that we take for granted, is considered an ace, and that's what the B'nai Bina understood. So again, in that vein, we're going to be discussing things which are nature, but appreciating that they are godless habore. As we mentioned, we spoke about issues in the past. There have been some fascinating issues which are no longer relevant that have been discussed in the past in medical halacha. For example, in the 16th century, there was the belief that ingesting parts of ancient Egyptian mummies was actually of medicinal value. And the Radbaz has a lengthy discussion about this. You actually find discussions also in the Magid Mishnah and other places. This is a chapter of the past. You have discussions in the 17th century about smallpox and the vaccination of smallpox. And smallpox hasn't been seen in any natural spontaneous case in the world since the 1970s. An eradicated disease, obviously thanks to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But that disease was extensively discussed in halachic literature in the 17th century and 18th century. And the issue of autopsy and anatomical dissection, which is obviously still relevant, it was a chapter from the 17th and 18th century. And the landscape today of contemporary medical halacha. And here are the basic textbooks that many people refer to. And to be honest, the lion's share of shilas that you get in medical halacha, probably 80% of the shilas that you get, or the questions, academic questions that you get, can be found in one of these svarim that you see on this slide. So you have the classic work, the Encyclopedia of Jewish Medical Ethics, which is translated from the Hebrew. I think now the second edition is seven or eight volumes, the Encyclopedia Hilchatit Rifuit. Of course, our own Rabbi Gedolim, Rabbi Bleif, and Rabbi Tendler, Mr. Shem, you'll hear from next week. Fred Rosner has contributed bountifully to the field of Jewish medical ethics. And here you have a sefer by Dr. Avraham Avraham called Nishmat Avraham, also published in the second edition, four volumes, goes according to Dalet Chelkei Shulchan Aruch. Just sort of as an aside for your libraries, if you're looking for one set of svarim or two set of svarim which will contain all your medical halachic issues, these two works, the Hebrew obviously, Encyclopedia Hilchatit Rifuit and Nishmat Avraham, will have almost everything that you will need in the field of medical halacha, very thorough, very comprehensive, with extensive source material. But to quote one of our founding fathers in the spirit of Thanksgiving, laws and institutions must go hand in hand with the progress of the human mind. As that becomes more developed, more enlightened, as new discoveries are made, new truths disclosed, institutions must advance also and keep pace with the times. The truth is that the basic medical halacha, or the basic halachic paradigm is, and the literature which we use most extensively in Paskening halacha, is the Shilas and Tshuvas literature. So in the Shilas and Tshuvas literature, the way it works is you wait for questions to be asked, and then the posek gives you a response to the question. However, in the 21st century, I would submit that science is progressing so rapidly that by the time we wait for many of these technologies to become clinical and for the questions to be asked, we will already be behind the eight ball. So we cannot afford to wait 5 years, 10 years before these technologies become available and then ask the shilas, and then and only then start thinking about the issues. We need to think prospectively. We need to concentrate on these issues now, so when they do become clinically relevant, we will be able to address them comprehensively, thoroughly, and halachically. So in that vein, I created this fictional journal, which is called the Journal of Anticipatory Medical Halacha. And we will go through a number of chapters of the Journal of Anticipatory Medical Halacha today. This is a journal that I started a number of years ago and is not found yet in bookstores. But chapters are continually being added to this. Every couple weeks, sometimes every couple days, there are chapters added to the Journal of Anticipatory Medical Halacha. So let us open the pages of the Journal of Anticipatory Medical Halacha and discuss the issues that we're going to be discussing today. Here are the chapters that we have for our discussion. The definition of maternity, animal-human chimeras. I'll explain all these terms, by the way, so fear not. And if I say anything in the midst of the lecture that requires clarification, don't hesitate to interject or raise your hand. I'm happy to clarify. Issues in abortion, genetics, stem cell research, non-vital organ transplants, selling organs, coma, and persistent vegetative state. Now, you can well imagine each one of these lines we could spend a number of hours on. The objective here is more a survey, just to share with you the latest developments in technology in all these areas and to show what the near future of medical halacha is going to look like. So let us begin with the issue of the definition of maternity. Here you have a cover from the New York Times Magazine, Her Body, My Baby. And here's the landscape. Here's the issue in surrogacy. the treatment of infertility is has exploded in the last few decades. So, for example, we're now in Sefer Bereishis. In Sefer Bereishis, three of the four imahos suffered from infertility. So I dare say, had they lived in the 21st century, they would have gone to their local reproductive endocrinologist and tried those methods before HaKadosh Baruch Hu would have had to intervene. In fact, the field of infertility is one of the most exciting fields in the practice of medicine, in the manipulation of the human reproductive seed, the male reproductive seed, the female reproductive seed, how it can be combined, where it can be combined. And that's partly what we're going to be talking about now, but I'm going to focus on one dimension. Obviously, the treatment of infertility encompasses many areas. The first halachic discussions began in the 1970s. When artificial insemination was introduced, which was harvesting the reproductive seed of the man and injecting it into the woman to accomplish fertility. And another treatment, and there are many treatments, and it depends on the circumstance, but another treatment that's used for infertility is called surrogate motherhood, and the technical term really is gestational hosthood, to have a gestational host. And when is this the scenario? This scenario is when a woman, we'll take a scenario A, a woman is a healthy woman who produces her own genetic material, produces her own eggs, has her own ovaries, but for a medical reason had to have her uterus, her womb, her rechem, her makor removed. So obviously she is incapable, at least as of now, and this may change as well, she is incapable of carrying a child, yet she has the genetic material to biologically produce a child. So what is the solution to this dilemma? The solution is to hire somebody or contract somebody. It doesn't necessarily have to be for money. It's another interesting halakhic issue. To take her husband's zera and her zera, fertilize it in the laboratory, take that fertilized embryo, and then implant that fertilized embryo into a third party. That third party is colloquially called a surrogate mother, technically called a gestational host. So the shaila is, in these kinds of arrangements, what are the halachic issues? And again, I apologize. There are, just to give you an idea of the complexity of these issues, Rabbi Brander and myself taught a full year course to the Supercolo guys here at YU about 5 years ago, entirely on infertility and halacha, covering the issues. We still didn't cover all the issues. So obviously there is a lot to discuss. But the basic bullet points, is there kibud pruvu for the man? Kibud av v'em, are you mechabe the genetic mother? Are you mechabe the gestational mother? Pidyon haben issues. Nationality is a big issue. So if one of the partners in this process is Jewish and one of the partners in this process is not Jewish, is the child a Jew or is the child not a Jew? Does the child need a giur? This is a major, major issue, and this is not science fiction by any stretch. These are Maisim B'chol Yom. Many, many from people are undergoing fertility treatments and are offered this option, and many people avail themselves of this option, and the question is, what are the halachic ramifications? Issues of yichus, yibum, issues of yerusha, financial support, etc. And one of the main concerns is, to whom do you send a card on Mother's Day? Do you send a card to your genetic mother, or do you send a card to your gestational mother? And of course, Hallmark Paskins, both mothers are considered the halachic mother. And it's come to such an extent where you might see this personal ad in the newspapers: I was reform as an embryo, conservative as a fetus, and orthodox from birth, seeking sane. So what we're going to do is I'm going to briefly share with you some of the classic halachic sources which are marshaled on this topic, and then we are going to discuss the challenges to the definition of maternity in the 21st century. So these are the sources today, Adayom Hazeh, which have been discussed in the issue of definition of maternity, and these are again just some of the highlights. So some of those who maintain the genetic mother is considered the halachic mother determine that based on both Pesukim in the Torah and from Gemara Nida. So it says in Tazria, Vayedaber Hashem Moshe Leimor, Daber B'nei Yisrael Leimor, Yishok Hi Tazria V'yoldo Zachor. So the mashmos here, and obviously it's not the context here is really issues of Tumah V'Tahara, but here the implication is that Yishok Hi Tazria, when a woman gives forth her Zera V'yoldo Zachor, and she gives birth to a male. parenthetically, this pasuk has been discussed throughout the centuries by Rishonim and Achronim. It's been used as a springboard for the discussion of reproductive embryology and physiology. And it's quite fascinating to follow the Mefarshim throughout the centuries, keeping in mind what was then understood in the history of medicine about the contribution of the female to conception. So, for example, back in the times of antiquity, it wasn't even clear what the woman contributed to the makeup of a child. While it was very clear that the man had a zera because the man's zera was emitted outside the body, it was not at all clear to anybody what the woman's contribution was, because the zera, the egg, the microscopic egg which is emitted from the ovary, was not postulated until the 1600s and was not visualized under the microscope until 1827. So you have millennia before where people were theorizing many different possibilities. And in fact, many people thought the woman's contribution was the damnida, because when a woman became pregnant, she stopped menstruating, and many thought that dam itself actually contributed to the formation of the fetus. Ad kadei kach that some scientists actually weighed the menstrual blood for 9 months to see if it would correlate with the weight of the fetus, and they found actually that there was a rough correlation between that menstrual blood. And there's other interesting areas in Chazal, for example, dam nikrash v'nasa cholav, that the dam actually becomes the milk. It's another theory which we didn't discuss in Nishtana Teva issues, but finds its place in that discussion. Then you have this Gemara Nida, which seems to be a more direct support to the position that the genetic mother, the egg donor, would be considered the legal mother of the child. Tana Rabbanan Shlosha Shut V'Nyesh V'Adam, there are three partners in the creation of man, HaKadosh Baruch Hu V'Avi V'Imo, Avi Mazriya HaLovim, the father emits the white substance, Shemi Menu Atzomos V'Gidim, Tzipornayim, etc., etc., Imo Mazras Odem, and the woman gives forth the red substance. Here again, assumedly referring to the Dam Nida. But the woman gives forth the red substance, shemimenu, oru, basar, isaris, etc., etc. It's a magnificent Gemara. It says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu invests these inanimate substances, the eyes with the power of vision, the ear with the power, the ears with the power of hearing, the mouth with the power of speech, the legs with the power of ambulation, the brain with the power of thought and reason. And it says when a time comes for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to be no del felco, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu rescinds his contribution, then you're just left with the lifeless, inanimate body. But anyway, what we can extract from here is that there are three partners in the creation of man, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Bo'ev, and Imo, and it seems to be that the one, the Imo, is considered the one who's Mazras Odem, who gives forth the Zera. So some use this source to determine that in fact it is the genetic mother that contributes to the makeup of a child, and that's considered the halachic mother. There is another line of thought in the halachic discussions, which is based on Parsha from a few weeks ago, and that is the story of the Medrash of Leah and Rachel. And here's the essence of this discussion. You have in the context here a discussion of the birth of the children of Yaakov to Leah, and it says Vatahar od Leah vatelet bein shishi li Yaakov. And that sixth child was Zvulun. So at this point, the Chumash, by the way, mentions Vatahar Vatelet, Vatahar Vatelet for every one of Leah's children. It doesn't deviate from that literary form, Vatahar Vatelet. But it deviates when it reaches the birth of Dina. And it's by Dina it says, Ve'achar Yoldobas. And afterwards, Dina gave birth to a daughter, Vatikra Es Shema Dina. And her name was called Dina. So the Mefarshim pick up on this as Gemara and Brachos, and other Midrashim discuss it. And here is the way the Medrash goes, and there are different lines of the Medrash. But in essence, the one which is relevant for our discussion is that Leah at this stage had given birth to six of the 12 Shvatim, and she was now pregnant. And she was now pregnant with a male child. And Rachel was pregnant with a female child. So Leah was donadin ba'atzma. Leah apparently knew by some nevuah that there would be 12 shvatim to Yaakov. And she knew she had already given birth to six. Bilhah had given birth to two. Zilpah had given birth to two. So that leaves only two remaining shvatim. So she said to herself, my poor sister Rachel, she's gotten a raw deal from the beginning. If I give birth to another male child, then she will only be giving birth to one of the 12 Shvatim and will even be on a lesser status than Bilhah and Zilpah. So what did she do? She was mispalel, according to this line of the Medrash, and I'm not going to discuss the others now. According to this line of the Medrash, she was mispalel that her fetus should switch with Rachel's fetus, and there would be an intrauterine transfer, so that now she would carry a female child, and Rachel would carry the male child, and her prayers were answered. That is why it says, Ve'acha yolda bas, and afterwards she gave birth to a bas, because it can't say Vatahar Vatelet, because she did not conceive the bas. She only gave birth to the bas. So it can't say Vatahar Vatelet. Of course, you'll ask me a shiloh, and it's a good shiloh. It says Vatar Vatelet for Yosef. So it's a good shiloh. It's a kasha and a medrash. But anyway, the way this medrash is learned out is that extracted from this medrash is that we generally consider Dina to be the daughter of Leah and Yosef to be the daughter of Rachel, which seems to imply that it's the birth mother is considered the halachic mother and not the genetic mother, not the mother who gave the genetic material. Yes?
The braisa nida that Isha is Mizra'as Odom, so that's only B'shas Hazra, or it could be B'hem Shecha Hereyon, in which case, if you put it in somewhere else, so then for those 9 months, the it maybe be Zeb Zangorim on some level, but it would be... It wouldn't be...
Oh, I see. Yeah.
If you assume that Mezras means, like, if the Isha is Mezras Tchilos, then it's Nilva Ben, and that, like, that more, since only B'shas Maisa Bia, so then Milo, but it could be Mezras...
Right, the only reason I would respond to that is that if you want to maintain the parallel of the Gemara, so the Aviv Mazria Loven, so his contribution is a one-time contribution,
for sure.
Which seems to be something today, it's anachronistic to say genetics, but using the term genetics... so then her parallel contribution would be that one-time contribution with the uniting of the two Zeras.
But your point contribution is ongoing.
Right. And if
so I'm not
but
sure.
Your point is definitely well taken. Definitely well taken. And it really speaks to the fact, and I hasten to point out over here, this is a medrash. Nobody relies exclusively on this medrash to paskin the issue of maternity. And the complexity of extracting from midrashim in general to paskin halacha is a matter of intense debate. Some say if there's no other competing source in the Bavli or Yerushalmi and you have a medrash, then you could possibly rely on the medrash. Others say even in that case you can't necessarily rely on the medrash. But the point here also, which we'll see when we get to the contemporary stuff and the challenges to maternity, is that in some of these cases that could not theoretically have been anticipated by the Rishonim and early Achronim, finding relevant source material is a tremendous challenge. So finding relevant source halachic source material to paskin an issue of surrogacy is no small feat. You know, so you're talking issues of abortion. Abortion is as old as the birth of the human being. You're talking end-of-life issues. Even though they're respirators, there's still issues of end-of-life and assisted suicide existed centuries ago. But the things that we're talking about now never existed. So they could not have been anticipated, at least in a direct sense. So it's very challenging for Poskim to find relevant source material. Here's other source material, which finds from the agricultural sources, Gemara and Sota, Yalda Shesivcha Vizkena, Batla Yalda Vizkena, the Ein Badin Orla. So the Shaila is, again, a very clever source in extrapolating to the definition of maternity, but one you could clearly ask kashers on. And the source is like this. If you take the Din of Orla, you guys know, 3 years trees grow in Eretz Yisrael. The first 3 years, you can't partake of the fruit. Fourth year, it's Netar Ravai, you have to bring to Yerushalayim, and after that, you can partake of the fruit. So let's say you have a tree, which is a two-year-old tree, and you cut off a limb of that two-year-old tree, and it has fruit on the limb. And then you graft it onto a six-year-old tree. What's the halachic status of the fruit now on that limb on the six-year-old tree? Does it now become identified with the tree onto which it's grafted, takes on a six-year status, and then is mutar b'achila now? Or do you have to wait the chronological age of that tree limb that was grafted, wait till it reaches 4 years, and then take it up to Yerushalayim, and then and only then? So here, and admittedly, this shaila is discussed elsewhere in the Gemara, and Maskon is different. But in this case, the Gemara says, Batal Yaldav Zkena, that it becomes batal to the tree, meaning that once it becomes integrated into the recipient tree, then it takes on the identity of that tree. So some use that argument as when you transfer the ovum to the woman, it becomes integrated into her body, and then therefore the halachic mother is the birth mother. This source is also used for discussions about organ donation. So, for example, if someone receives a heart transplant, does that heart, for example, kvura issues? If someone donates the heart, the lung, livers, kidneys, and then the recipient dies, you have to remove that organ from the recipient and find the kever of the donor and bury it with the donor. Is it still the donor's heart, lungs, liver, or is it the does it belong to the recipient? So here the pashtus is that once it becomes integrated into the recipient, it is part of the recipient's body. Here you have another fascinating source, which has been marshaled in the discussion of maternity, Hadassah Sheila Biologit Mishpatit. And here the source they mention nearly Lahar Mishas Bav Metzia Shotof Nahar Zesov Nichnas Latov Sada Chaveru. So you had a person who had a field, and in that field were, and it's also relevant for Hanukkah, in that field were olive trees, and there was a flood, and the flood waters carried the olives into the neighboring field. And they started to grow in that neighbor's field, and now they're producing fruit. So the neighbor said, you know, it's my field which gestated the tree, and therefore I should have rights to the olives. And the first field owner says, well, it's my olives, it's my genetic material which gives you these olives, so it's the genetics which should be the determinant. So the Gemara there says, Yachloku. Now, obviously, Yachloku is the Solomonic solution. You know, you take the embryo, you could divide the embryo in half, I guess. These days, if you do that, it's called cloning. So some say, based on this Gemara, that it should be both the mothers should be considered the halachic mother, both the genetic mother should be considered the halachic mother, and the birth mother should be considered the halachic mother.
Who was that who brought that proof?
That actually is not so much mentioned by contemporary poskim. Here you have the source, Chernotovsky, I don't know how to pronounce his name. But the context of this source was brought, and actually eliminated the slides because I didn't want to go into a tangent about it, but there's a fascinating, I'll spend just 1 minute on this. There's a very fascinating halachic discussion about the definition of maternity in the very early 20th century. So there is a shiloh which for the very first time appeared in a journal called Habe'er in 1907. And the shiloh was, if you have a transplantation of the uterus and the ovaries, from one woman to another woman, who's considered the halachic mother of that child? And since you're transplanting the uterus, what are the issues of bechor in that child? And that spawned, if you will, a lengthy halachic discussion in the early 1900s up through the 20th century on issues of organ transplantation by ovarian transplant and uterus transplant. And all the Gedolei HaPoskim always assumed that that was purely fictional, purely hypothetical, never could have been a case like that in 1907. But the fact of the matter is it was not theoretical. And I did the medical historical research, and there was actually one case published in 1906 of a physician who did a genuine ovarian transplant with the resulting production of a healthy child in the recipient. Remarkable case. For those of you who are interested, please email me. I'll send you more than you'd ever want to know about this case. This source was mentioned in the halachic discussions, in the halachic literature, ensuing that case, which, to be honest, even contemporary physicians and scientists aren't aware of it. I wrote an article on it. I sent a copy of the article to Sherman Silber, who is a pioneer of fertility research, who actually did the first modern ovarian transplant a number of years ago, in addition to a number of other pioneering things. So the classic source here, which is discussed, Rabbi Bleich discusses this source extensively, and many of the posts can spend a lot of time on this source. This is a source from the Gemara Yevamos. Shnei Achim Te'umim Gerim, two brothers whose mother converts. So these are twins. A woman is carrying twins. She undergoes a giur in the midst of her pregnancy. So it says shnei achim te'umim gerim. So if they are two brothers that have been born and they are alive and they want to be and they undergo a giur, so lo cholzin v'lo miyavnim. So as you all well know, the halacha is that all familial ties are dissolved once gerus takes place, and even in the raisa, brother and sister can marry each other. So there's no relationship at all between these two brothers once they are born and they convert after birth. However, Haisa Horasan Shalobik Dusha Vladasan Bikdusha. However, if they Horasan, they were conceived when before their mother converted, but their mother converted while they were in utero in the midst of pregnancy. Vladasan Bikdusha, Lo Holtsin Glomiadnim, Aval, Chayav Mishum Eshisach. So when they're born, the Isser of Erva for Eishes Ach applies amongst the two brothers, one to each other. So what does that indicate to us? That indicates to us that these brothers now do have a sibling, a fraternal relationship with each other. How could that relationship have been established? Because in utero, when the Giyur took place, all bonds were dissolved. So what then generated the relationship? So some argue that it's the birth which created the relationship. Since they were born to the same mother, that now creates a maternity, so therefore it's the birth, not the genetics. Yes? Chalitza is more for the mother, from the mother, than the father. So they wouldn't do chalitza into the other. Let's see. Chalitza would be maternally dependent, I think. Yeah, because that wife is no... She didn't have a child which was her halachic child. I'll get back to that, but I think it's a maternal issue, not a paternal issue. Another classic source. So this source is mentioned by many, many people, discussed extensively. Another one in Purim, it says Vayhi Omenis Hadasahi Esther Bas Dodo. So when the Megillah talks about Esther, says Ke'en Lo Av Va'Em, she doesn't have a Ein Lo Av Va'Em. She didn't have a father or a mother. So what does it mean she didn't have a father or a mother? Here, Rav Yosef Engel discusses the notion that she didn't have a father because after Bia, the father died before conception took place. And the mother died before the child was born, or as the child was being born. So he's medayik from here that maternity, what does it mean? How could she not have a mother or father? So she didn't have a mother because the mother died in childbirth. Mashma, that the maternity only evolves when the child was actually born. So since the child, and he says, this is partially dependent on the fact that uber yerech imo, which is another sugi which is discussed in the issue of maternity, that the uber is considered an integral part of the mother, not a separate and distinct matter. And that uber yerech imo, by the way, is mentioned in the discussions about the Gemara Yevamos, about these two boys that are converted in utero. How do you accomplish conversion? Because of uber yerech imo. So since uber yerech imo, you cannot be a separate, distinct being until you're born. Only when you're born and the baby separates itself from the mother, then you have the possibility of introduction of maternity. So Lamaisa, all the positions of maternity have been espoused in the contemporary halachic literature. No halachic mother, according to the Tzitz Eliezer, because conception takes place outside the body. Genetic mother, birth mother, both mothers. There's also an added discussion that you can that's machalic between the Yahadus, but Kedushas Yisrael. So you can still be a halachic Jew, but you'll need Kedushas Eretz Yisrael, Kedushas Am Yisrael, which you can only accomplish through Geirus. But yes. That's a brisker shita. I don't remember who it is. It's a brisker shita. Yeah, I think it's Ravaron and this Rabbi Ralbag in a Teres Shlomo also brings it down. But when I started lecturing about maternity many years ago, when the issue came on the scene, the preponderance of rabbinic opinion seemed to have been that it was the birth mother who was considered the halachic mother. But now the pendulum has swung in the other direction. And in fact, the majority of poskim, and again, majority is not so relevant necessarily, but it seems that a number of poskim have adopted the position that it's the genetic mother is considered the halachic mother, and this appeared in January of this year in the Jerusalem Post, which followed a conference by Pua, which some of you are familiar with here at YU, that we have some relationship with Pua, which is a wonderful organization that deals with issues of infertility in halacha, and they announced at their conference that the majority of rabbinic opinion is that the genetic mother is considered the halachic mother. Here you have a letter by the Rishon Lezion, Shlomo Amar, writing, Emes nachon adomer shekein ha'leisi b'fnei maron gon Yisrael, a Rishon Lezion of Avad Yosef, said, I went to Avad Yosef to ask his psak on this, v'hiskim lozeh sheholchim achar ba'alata beitzit. And he passed, and then we go by the genetic mother. And he also says, V'chein shamati, be'omrim li, shekein das, agon, agodol, mefursum, Rabbi Yosef Shalom el Yashiv Shlita, and that is true. And there are articles discussing his, el Yashiv Shlita's position that he holds also the genetic mother was considered the halachic mother. So that's really the basic landscape today, which we find ourselves in the early 21st century. What I'd like to spend the next few minutes talking about is what are going to be the challenges to the definition of maternity now as we move forward. And these really are mind-boggling possibilities. So let us begin with this possibility. And this is stems from a number of years ago. Here you have a slide from a conference which took place in London about a year or two ago called Animal-Human Embryonic Combinations, an Ethical Discussion. And in the context of that conference, they discussed the following. They said, what if we took a human embryo and we placed it in the womb of a cow, and we gestated it in the womb of a cow? So they, in that conference, obviously, they weren't discussing the halachic ramifications, but they discussed the ethics of it, and obviously many people were revulsed by the concept. Some people thought it was a great idea, especially the women in the group thought it was a great idea. It would be much more convenient for the baby to be gestated in a cow than for them to have to suffer for 9 months. So the shaila is, who would be considered the halachic mother in such a scenario? I suspect that over the next few minutes, you guys are going to be asking me, you know, A, why do I care in these kinds of wild scenarios, and B, why would anyone want to do such a thing? And the answer to that is not such a simple answer. I mean, the answer is, first of all, if it can be done, scientists will do it. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has it built in the Teva that it's possible to be done. Scientists will push the envelope. But as I mentioned, in this case, I mean, imagine the scenario of a woman taking her fertilized embryo and transferring it to a cow for gestation. It's really just like an incubator, and you just pick it up after 9 months. It'd be so much more convenient, especially career women that are interested in not stopping their careers, to have this kind of option, this kind of scenario. So there are some fascinating halachic sources which have been marshaled by contemporary poskim on this very current and new issue. So here you have, and I think the Levi Yitzhak Halpern in Maasei Choshev brings this source. Hamapelas min behema chayev ha'of, bein tmein, bein tahorim, im zachar teshev lezachar, bein nekeva teshev nekeva. So if a woman is mapelas, a woman has a spontaneous miscarriage, and she miscarries a being which appears to be an animal. Behema chayev ha'of, bein tmein, bein tahorim. So what is Rav Meir Paskin, im zachar teshev lezachar, im nekeva teshev nekeva. So if it's a male, then she observes the tumah v'tahara of a male. If it's a female, she observes the tumah v'tahara of a female. What's the implication? The implication is, or the inference is, that that it's like it has the status of a human fetus. Yeah?
Can you summarize about at what point you determine that a blad and the notes are, let's say, it's a blad, and then some of the tahara. Is it something to do with, you know, the din of when an animal becomes a human?
Correct, but at the same time, and I agree with you, and obviously you're not going to use this as your sole source in posking these issues, but the mere fact that you're acknowledging the status as a human status to confer tumah v'tahara, you know, and in fact, that's really what they're extrapolating from this, that it has the status enough to confer tumah v'tahara. You could say, mako behema, so there's no tumah v'tahara because it's not a human being. And only tumah v'tahara is generated by the birth of a human being. So again, your point is well taken, and you could be medayik, you know, there's no question these aren't like the classic direct extrapolation sources for our issues. But the Gemara in Nida says, so the Gemara asks, so according to Rabbi Meir, who seemed to understand that a woman who gives birth to an animal type being, that animal type being is Vladna Alya, is considered a human fetus for some purposes. What about the converse? What about an animal that gives birth to a humanoid creature? What is the halachic status of that? So Gemara says, "My nafkamina." Yeah, Gemara asks the question, "Why do I care?" What a ridiculous question! So Gemara says, "Lashteruye b'achila." Whether you can shecht, you know, if either ben pakua, maybe whether you shecht all the fetuses inside, or when it comes out, if you can shecht it, if it's born from an animal, it's considered an animal. Then can you shecht it and can you eat it? So an interesting discussion in the Gemara. And in fact, Levi Yitzchak Halperin, in a sefer written by Hanina Rottenberg, a small volume on some medical halachic issues, has a one essay devoted to behema pundakait, which is having a gestational animal surrogate mother. And they actually at least entertain the theoretical possibility of the following. So Zulfiza Yesh Lomar, the Huadin, in Ya Behema Pundakait, Havlad Shabimea, Filo in Hi Adam, Imu Adam, Hu Nidam Ki Behema, Ulufachos Ki Goy Velo Ki Yisra. And Maaseh Hashem, Levi Yitzchak Halperin writes, In Kain, Benito Didan, Ikalas Fuke Tuva, Shema Dina Ki Behema. Maybe a fetus, which is a human fetus born to an animal, is considered a behema, which is quite a wild thing. So, what other challenges do we have to the definition of maternity? We have the following scenario. We read Ashlosh Shut Vin Yesh Ba'adam. There's three partners in the creation of man: the father, the mother, and the Kadosh Baruch Hu. So here you have, and the father creates, gives the zera, and the woman gives her zera, gives the egg, but now you have, you know, a number of other options on the table. British scientists say they have created human embryos containing DNA from two women and a man in a procedure that researchers hope might be used one day to produce embryos free of inherited disease. So what's the scenario here? The scenario here is you extract the DNA from one woman, the nucleus, which contains the majority of the DNA, and the cytoplasm of another woman. The cytoplasm doesn't contain a lot of material, but it does contain what are called mitochondrial DNA. So there is a small percentage, one, maybe less than 1% of the DNA, which comes from the mitochondria, which sits outside the nucleus. So that mitochondria, and actually there are diseases which are transmitted maternally, which are, because they're only found in the DNA within the mitochondria of the ovum. And there was very severe diseases. They're mitochondrially transmitted diseases. So you have an egg which has a genetic combination of the cytoplasm and mitochondrial DNA of one woman and the nuclear DNA of another woman. So the shaila is, you know, who's considered the halachic mother of this child? You know, if, according to those for sure who paskin that the genetic mother is considered the halachic mother of the child, you know, there's now more potential for shutfim. It's not just Shlosha Shutfin, there's possibly four Shutfin, and then there's the physician who does the procedure, it's another Shutfin. And we can see you can splice DNA from three or four people now these days, and that's really very much contemporary, not even science fiction. So the Shaila is, what is the significance of these contributions? You know, is the DNA from this mitochondria, or is the cytoplasm have enough significance for Sarah Valyashi, who holds genetic mother, to give chashivas to that and say maybe both of these people are considered the genetic mother out of Suffolk? More for you guys to think about. And as if this isn't complicated enough, this scenario literally blows the roof off of the definition of maternity. And here's the technology. And it relates to stem cell research. We're actually going to spend a little bit of time on stem cell research as well. But here's the basic technology, which is at the cusp, not yet produced a child, but could very well in the very near future. You have a woman. They extract from her bone marrow a stem cell. That stem cell can then be guided in the laboratory here. Stem cells are taken from an infertile male's bone marrow. I'll use a female for our scenario. Two, they are cultivated in chemical soup that turns them into sperm cells. Here's the key factor. When they do this chemical soup, they can turn it into gamete cells. The gamete cells can be either sperm or eggs at that stage. So you have a woman, they take her stem cells from her bone marrow, they can cultivate those bone marrow stem cells to produce either sperm or eggs. So they produce sperm from her own bone marrow stem cell, they then take her own egg and fertilize her egg with that sperm, and then implant that into her body for gestation. She gives birth to that child. Who is the halachic father of that child? I mean, how are you going to paskin this kind of shayla?
Is there some source that says that a woman can't be a father?
Is there some source? Excellent. So some people ask the cloning. In cloning, there was a discussion about who's considered, and this is different than cloning. This is taking, because this child will not be a clone, because you're taking a gamete, which is haploid, which is half the DNA, combined with the other half of DNA, it's not an exact clone, different procedure. So you're going to produce a different type of child. So is there, I mean, I don't know if there's a specific source that says that a woman can't be a father, but obviously the assumption is that only a male is a candidate to be a father. So, all right, so I don't see why either. But that's precisely the question. What do we use for guidance in paskening these kinds of shilas? So this, obviously, you and I aren't going to paskin this kind of shaila at our desk. These are the things which are omed in Baruma Shel Olam about the definition of it, literally the definition of a human being, the definition of what constitutes a father, what constitutes a mother. So is it possible to say that a woman has the halachic status of a father? Or is it simply impossible that the only viable candidate for paternity is a male? The only possible candidate for maternity is a human female, so a cow is simply not on the list of people that can be a halachic mother, and we'll see other options. But here it's it's a true challenge. And someone started. Here's an interesting thought. An article is written in a recent Asya, beginning to delineate some of these halachic issues. Hafraya be'emtzaut zera melachuti, which means fertilization through the use of artificial reproductive seed. And I point your attention to one category here, mamzerus. Interesting possibility about resolving the mamzerus issues. Let's say you have a man who is a mamzer. I mean, not a colloquial mamzer, a halachic mamzer, and his progeny will all be mamzerim. So let's say he takes a bone marrow stem cell and produces a sperm cell from that, and then fertilizes a woman, and produces a child as a result. Is his mamzerus conferred and transmitted through that artificially produced zera? Or perhaps the status of mamzerus is only transmitted through natural bia and through natural conception? Some say even artificial insemination itself might circumvent the transmission of mamzerus and might break the lineage of mamzerus. But this is even a huge step further than that. You're creating an artificial zera, which is not the zera which was produced in his reproductive tract. So perhaps this would be a solution for him to have a child that's genetically his child, but has no halachic status of being a mamzer. Something to think about. So we talked about the possibility of a woman being a father, and the possibility of a cow being a mother. But what if you have neither cow nor anybody else in the process of gestation? What if you do what's called ectogenesis? Ecto, it means outside the body. Genesis means obviously birth, production of the human being. So ectogenesis, the concept of ectogenesis is the following. That you fertilize the embryo, the sperm and the egg, and you take this fertilized embryo and you implant it in not in a human being or not in an animal, but you cultivate it and gestate it entirely in the laboratory from beginning to end. Now this hasn't yet happened. It's not even legal. It's possible to... So they're working on early periods of gestation, and they're working on late periods of gestation. There's obviously a huge gap in the middle that they have to overcome. But scientists, reputable scientists, are genuinely working on these things. Nothing that we are talking about today is pure science fiction. Everything we're talking about today is based on real science. Whether this will actually come to fruition, nobody knows, but reputable scientists believe that in 10 years from now, 20 years from now, the possibility of ectogenesis will exist. So here also, who's considered the halachic mother? Is it possible that maybe this test tube, if you wanted to argue that the mother could be the halachic father, so maybe this test tube will be the halachic mother of this child. I mean, it's pushing it to the absurd. So obviously there's certain people who are not viable candidates. So would you argue the default position then that the genetic mother would be the halachic mother, or would you argue that this child has no mother because it wasn't born from a woman? Yes.
Where do you think gametes come from? The sperm and the egg are coming from people?
Oh yeah, they're coming from human beings. All human. Assumedly. I mean, you can obviously have variations there, but they're coming from humans. And another frontier, male pregnancy. Here's a cute cartoon. The uterus transplant was a success. I'm sure you'll find your husband much more understanding now. So again, sort of turning things on its head, about who's considered the mother, who's considered the father. Now, the basic theory here, again, this is not really science fiction. There is some scientific possibilities here. And one of the possibilities is that, for example, for people who have their bladders removed, scientists can now regenerate or create a bladder in the laboratory and surgically implant that bladder. How do they do such a thing? They take stem cells and they create a scaffolding of natural biodegradable material, and the stem cells then grow on that scaffolding, then the biodegradable material degrades, breaks down, and leaves what was created by the scaffolding and leaves a bladder. This concept of scaffolding has been used for many, many different areas in contemporary science. So the theory is if they can create a bladder, which is a big round organ, they can create a uterus for a man to be able to house a gestated child. And obviously there's much more to gestation than just housing a baby. There's nutritional elements, hormonal elements. So could these things be overcome? And the answer is scientists are genuinely working on the possibility. So until now we were talking about taking the human reproductive seed the issues were where it would be gestated, inside the womb, outside the womb, in an animal. But here is something more fundamental, the change of the human being himself. And this is the category of animal-human chimeras. And what's the concept here? And this was already in 2007. Scientists have created the world's first human-sheep chimera. Now, a chimera is a being that is comprised of cells from two different species that coexist with each other in that person. So the sheep here has 15% human cells and 85% animal cells. And here actually, you know, you have the Greek mythological characters, you know, human animal DNA embryo research. I don't know what all the fuss is about. Here you're going to ask me again, you know, why would anybody do such a thing? How bizarre is this? So here's the reason people do it. And here's a very concrete medical reason. We talked about organ transplants a few moments ago. So there are thousands of people that die in this country every year because they don't receive any organs. There aren't enough donors, living donors, cadaveric donors. So what do you do? So what you do is you take stem cells from the human being, liver stem cells, you inject them into a sheep at an early embryological age, such that the sheep will then grow within it a liver which is primarily comprised of human cells. Then you can harvest that liver from that sheep and transplant it into a human being. That's the theory. It hasn't yet happened. So the shaila is, what's the status of this sheep? This sheep that's grazing in the fields, is this sheep an animal or is it a human being? If you shechted the sheep, could you eat the liver? Or could you eat the other parts of the sheep? Now this is 15% and 85%. Let's say you had a sheep that's 51% human cells and it's grazing in the fields. Does that change the status of the sheep or does not change the status of the sheep? So here you have the Maaseh Choshev also brings this fascinating Yerushalmi. And again, you're going to ask me Kashi on the Yerushalmi, and that's fine, and we're not paskening from this Yerushalmi. When you have species that are unclear, whether they're human species or animal species, the Yerushalmi says, Hakol toli b'tzuras hapanim. Everything depends on the morphological features, the facial features of that being. She'im kulo adam u'panav kibehema. If it is a humanoid creature like this one here, upon of kibahema, but its face is like that of an animal. Afilu kore batora, omrim labov nishchotoscho. Even if he's standing up there laning, you can say, come, let's shecht you, because it's the facial features that determine the status of the person. Bim hayu, and the converse is also true. Bim hayu upon of ka'adam, if its face was like the face of a man, like this one. The kulo kibahema, but it's the rest of it is an animal. The choresh basada, and it's plowing the fields. Say, come, and you can perform chalitza, yibum, whatever you want to do, i.e., you have the status of a full human being. So here also, obviously we're not going to directly extrapolate to these contemporary issues, but it asks really fundamental questions about what's the definition of humanity. And people are beginning to do this kind of thing, to mix animals and human beings. This is not a real picture, don't worry, this is a Photoshopped picture. But the challenge of this generation, the challenge of the 21st century poster, is really going to be, in previous generations, for example, in the times of Copernicus, which we talked a little bit about last time, you know, the relationship of the Earth to the cosmos, to the sphere. So then there was a big debate about the place of the Earth with respect to the rest of the world. In the age of Darwin, there was a big debate about the relationship of man to the other animals on the face of the earth. And did we evolve from those animals? But the shaila in the 21st century is, what constitutes the definition of a human being? Who is a human being and what is a human being? You can mix so many different variations and permutations, a little bit of DNA from this one, a little bit of DNA from that one, a little bit of animal here, a little bit of human there. At what stage is this person an animal? At what stage are they a human being? Continuing further along in this vein, artificial life is now become a theoretical possibility. So here you had Craig Venter, who's one of the pioneers in the field of genetics and the Human Genome Project. And in essence, what he did, and this was reported in May of this year, scientists working to make a synthetic life form reported a major step forward Thursday, saying they had created an artificial genome and used it to bring a hollowed-out bacterium back to life. So what Venter did is he took a computer and manufactured DNA in a computer, hollowed out a bacterial cell, and injected his manufactured DNA into this hollowed-out cell. And this hollowed-out cell, the machinery that he had created in the laboratory, the DNA that he had created in the laboratory, began to function and take over the machinery of the cell and to produce within that cell and to create enzymes within that bacterium. Now, obviously, this is a single-celled organism, but the notion of truly artificial life is a theoretical prospect. And this, in July of this year, in the British Medical Journal, the U.S. Presidential Ethics Commission grapples with what is called synthetic biology. It moves from simply transferring genes from one organism to another to digitizing that genetic information with the capacity to reassemble it molecule by molecule in new combinations to create new organisms. So this is really a fascinating Shiloh. So what is the status of these? So for example, if you create a bacterium or you create something and it becomes non-microscopic and it becomes big enough that you can see in the eye, is there an Isser and Shabbos of killing it? Does it have a status of life or does it not have a status of life? You know, obviously, we're not talking about creating human beings. This fascinating Shiloh, which some of you may be familiar with, which is mentioned in the cloning literature, but here it's more relevant than in the cloning literature. Because cloning, you know, you're taking human cells and just extracting them and doing a little bit of manipulation. Here, we're talking about taking a computer and generating life from a computer, which is like the golem. So the Chacham Tzvi was asked, he said, Nistapakti Adam Hanotzer Al Yidei Sefer Yetzirah. A man that was created from Sefer Yetzirah, not born in the classic sense, not a progeny of gametes, human gametes, and produced as a human being. Also, Shemur B'Sanhedrin, Rava Bar Gavra, Rava created a man. Mitzaref La'asara, does he participate in a minion? Can you mitzaref this golem, who was created by Sefer Yetzirah, can he participate in a minion or not? More fundamentally, is there an Isser Ritzicha for such a creature? So these are the questions that are not any longer science fiction questions. These are real classic halachic shilas, which are going to be applied in full force in the upcoming decades to these kinds of issues. As we move into some other topics in the 21st century in our Journal of Anticipatory Medical Halacha, the issue of abortion has been discussed extensively in the halachic literature. I know Rabbi Willig usually gives the abortion shiur. Did he give this year?
Not yet?
Okay. So and he gives a wonderful shiur on halachic issues of abortion and the Tzitz Eliezer and the Rambam and the Rav Moshe and the different issues on these kinds of different halachic ramifications of the issue of abortion. But the main discussions there were predicated on a certain scientific reality. The scientific reality is that abortions are usually taking place in later gestational ages of pregnancy, but there is a theoretical possibility that information can be gleaned about a fetus in utero at very early stages of gestation, even before 40 days gestation. And as many of you know, the Gemara is machalic in a number of different places between pre-40-day gestation and post-40-day gestation. The Gemara says that before 40 days, the fetus is considered maya ba'alma. Now, what are the halachic ramifications of that? So Rav Moshe says it's not so halachically relevant, that even before 40 days, there's still an Isser Ritzicha for a vlad, or Ke'en Ritzicha for a vlad. But others are mechalic, and others say that if it's less than 40 days gestation, abortion may possibly be mutter, but for sure less halachically objectionable in a gestational phase of less than 40 days. So in this scenario, and again, this is not science fiction, this is real science, it is now possible to be able to harvest from the woman who is pregnant, you can do just a simple blood test. And from that blood test, you can extract some cells which migrated from the fetus into the maternal circulation. So now usually the fetal circulation and the maternal circulation are kept separate. But it, literally a handful of cells can sometimes migrate out into the maternal circulation. If you can extract these cells from a blood sample from the mother, you can send that cell, the fetal cell, to the laboratory and be able to determine the genetics of that fetus. So this, in theory, and this hasn't been developed to the fullest extent yet, in theory this could be done at a less than 40-day gestational age. So if you're able to do that now, the shilas that you are going to be getting as rabbanim are going to change significantly. Now, Rabbi, you know, I just found out I'm pregnant. I just went to the doctor. You know, I'm 28 days or 35 days gestation, and my doctor told me that my baby has Down syndrome, or my baby has Tay-Sachs disease, my baby has some other disease which they just discovered the genetics for. Can I perform an abortion or can I not perform an abortion? Rabbi, you know, if you want to do it for 40 days, you got 3 days to decide because the time limit is up. So these are the kinds of shilas which you are going to be asked as the landscape evolves. Which brings us into the whole field of genetics, which has many, many shilas. I was speaking to one of the rabbanim here just now when I came in, and one of the poskim here in yeshiva, and he was saying that there is a serious concern because the rabbanim need to be updated on the medicine and the science, because they're getting lots and lots of shilas about the genetics that are evolving in the 21st century. One of the classic shilas is a woman who was found to have a genetic predisposition to breast cancer. So what are the halachic shilas that relate to it? First of all, if she has a family history as a teenager who's in Stern, mechuyev to test to see if she even has this breast cancer gene. If she ends up having this breast cancer gene, what can be done? Do you need to have a surgery to remove both breasts to prevent the possibility of breast cancer? And uterine cancer is also a theoretical possibility. Maybe you should have a hysterectomy also to prevent the possibility of cancer. If you're engaged, you're going out with somebody, do you have to share with your potential chassan that you are positive for the breast cancer gene? Does it rise to the threshold, the level of requirement for disclosure of that information? So these are not at all theoretical questions. These are very, very real and complex questions. And that's the field of genetics, which has mushroomed in the past few decades, and which is expanding exponentially. And just to give you an idea of the role of the Jews in the evolution of the understanding of genetics, first of all, one of the earliest genetic tests that was offered was for Tay-Sachs disease back in the back in the 70s when the shilas came out about whether it's mutter to perform an abortion for Tay-Sachs. But now the breast cancer gene is one of the classic genes which has been discovered in the entire field of medicine. So it's not just a side chapter in modern medicine. It is a major, major player in the field of understanding genetic testing. And just to give you an idea, in the New England Journal, which is the definitive journal of medicine here in the United States, in the very first issue dealing with a new series called Genomic Medicine, an updated primer, this past year, co-authored by Francis Collins, who headed up the Human Genome Project and subsequently took over the entire National Institutes of Health. What is the first case of the first premier article on introducing this new segment in the New England Journal? A 40-year-old mother of three, and the history file, your office electronic record systems alerts you to the fact that Kathy is of Ashkenazi Jewish heritage and has several relatives with breast cancer, putting her at heightened risk for the hereditary breast and ovarian cancer syndrome. So what do they talk about? This, BRCA1. How do they know this BRCA1? They know it from testing on us, on the Jewish community. That's how they know it from. And that's the impact that we have had on the contemporary genetics landscape. And another area which some of you may be familiar with, which is going to become more available and more complicated over time as time evolves, is a procedure called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. Now, just by show of hands, so I know where you guys are on this, how many people have ever heard of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis? Okay, interesting. So about 10-20% of the class has heard of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. By the time you guys are out poskening these issues in 10 years from now, everybody will know pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. It will not be something which only some of you know. it'll be intimately familiar to all of you. What is pre-implantation genetic diagnosis? So we said that the original Shilas back in the 70s, when genetic testing came on the horizon, and specifically Tay-Sachs disease, the Shilas that were presented to the Gedolia Postum at that time were, is it permitted to perform an abortion? So if you have a couple that is nowadays, because of testing like organizations like Dor Yesharim and others who are performing genetic testing, many people find out before they marry if they're, quote, genetically compatible to be able to marry, and if they if they're both carriers for certain genetic conditions, and they find that out, and they many of them elect not to continue going out and not to marry each other. But let us say that a couple is engaged to be married or already married, and find out that they're both carriers for certain genetic diseases, the classic example being Tay-Sachs disease. So 30 years ago, their only option was to undergo amniocentesis during pregnancy, and then the Shiloh was a very difficult Shiloh, but whether to undergo abortion or not to undergo abortion. But not so in the 21st century. What is the option available to them? The option available to them is pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, and it works in the following way. They harvest the reproductive seed of the man and the woman, the zera of the man and the woman, fertilize it in the laboratory, and they allow the egg to grow to the 8-cell stage. This is the 8-cell stage. This is a human embryo. They then extract one cell from that egg. And this is the process. This is the pipette, extracting, beginning, budding the embryo here, beginning to extract one cell here, and almost completely extracting that one of 8 cells here. They then send that one microscopic cell to the laboratory and do a genetic analysis on that cell, everything that's known in the genetic world at that time. They can then determine with definity if that embryo is a Tay-Sachs embryo or not a Tay-Sachs embryo. If it's found to have genes, both recessive genes for Tay-Sachs, and will invariably develop Tay-Sachs disease, they will not implant that embryo, and they'll implant only the embryos that do not have the disease. Now, this can obviously be applied to every genetic disease. You can also do this, by the way, to determine if the embryo has the breast cancer gene. You can also do it to determine if the embryo is a male or a female. If you wanted to have a male child, which and there's no law against being able to do that. So couples in the United States will present to a fertility specialist and say, I'd like to have a boy. Can you please do pre-implantation genetic diagnosis and guarantee that I will have a boy? So the potential uses are truly extraordinary. So the notion of people wanting to dissociate procreation from marital relations is not so far-fetched. So you can envision a scenario whereby, you know, a couple gets married and they'll practice contraception, and then when they want to have a child, they'll go to the laboratory. I'm not talking about in the firm world, I'm talking about in the general society. When they want to have a child, they'll go to the laboratory, they'll do pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, and they'll, you know, determine all the potential bad things that their embryos have. They'll discard the ones that have any genetic conditions, and they'll take the ones that are free of known genetic diseases, and they'll implant those. You know, why would you leave anything to chance when you can send everything to the laboratory and determine with certainty about what's going to happen? Now, of course, we know that, obviously, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has a grander plan over here. You try and circumvent things. The divine plan is in place no matter what. But at the same time, if science allows you the capability to circumvent certain things, you know, perhaps we should be encouraging that kind of thing. So, in fact, the Gedolia Postum do allow the use of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis for major genetic diseases. The question, and here you have a classic example. Rabbi Fold, who's involved with us here at Yeshiva University, is responsible for the development of a PGD lab in Shaarei Tzedek. And here you have a report from the Jerusalem Post. It has now been established with the imprimatur of the Gedolia Poskim, with Rav Elyashiv's psak, that they have an active PGD lab, one of the most active in the world, and it has been responsible for the birth of dozens and dozens of children who are now free of genetic disease, who could have been afflicted with a genetic disease. And using breast cancer, and using this to test for breast cancer gene is also a theoretical possibility, and the Shiloh is really the fundamental Shiloh, which we're just touching on and raising here this afternoon, is what are the permissive uses for pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. So where are you going to draw your lines about when you're going to be mater a couple to undergo PGD? So are you going to allow them to do it for Tay-Sachs disease? The answer is clearly yes. Are you going to allow them to do it for for the breast cancer gene. Now, Tay-Sachs disease is a disease that if the fetus is affected with Tay-Sachs disease, there's 100% mortality of that child within a few years of life. But a woman with breast cancer gene may develop the disease, may not develop the disease. When she develops it, she might be cured. If she knows she has it, she can protect herself from getting it. So you're going to prevent the birth of a child with a breast cancer gene? And if you start doing that, what's going to be with all these people that have the breast cancer gene? Are they going to be considered an inferior race? Our insurance is going to discriminate against these people because they were born and they shouldn't have been born? So the potential is great here for abuse. Yes? Oh, okay, good. So the reason you wouldn't allow it, the halachic reason is, first of all, hotzah zera levatol.
How do they extract
zera?
Yeah.
Okay, so in standard, and these shalas have been discussed extensively in the infertility literature. So you have a couple that wants to undergo infertility treatment. How do you harvest the zera from the man? How do you harvest the zera from the woman? So they're very detailed, extensive discussions. So what they can do, and the most obvious way is just to have a man be motzi zera himself. So obviously that's the most objectionable way from our perspective. But that's what the physician will do on a first visit with a family who suffers from infertility. Halachically directed couple will undergo other types of procedures before they do the hotzah zera, and hotzah zera can be done in less objectionable ways. So, for example, postcoitally, after shimush, after bia, perhaps they can harvest the zera that way, or in some cases, if that's not preferable, to use a condom. And each one of these, there's many halachic discussions about how these things are to be procured. Testicular biopsy is a very radical form and is generally not used. But so zera for a woman is less halachically objectionable. There's no isser of hashchasa zera for a woman, but it is a more serious procedure because it's a surgical procedure where you take a needle, you insert it into the ovary to extract the eggs. So that's the reason why it shouldn't be permitted, you know, wholesale for everybody all the time. So they've even discovered a gene for predilection to certain athletic ability. You know, so is it permitted to be able to do PGD for this kind of thing? Now, let me assure you guys, no Jews have this gene, so you don't have to worry about this. Another fascinating area is population genetics. How many of you guys have heard about the Cohen gene? Everybody here heard about the Cohen gene. So I hope we're actually going to have this. It's not sure yet, but February, we have scheduled for February 13th. The Medical Ethics Society is having we're having another one of our conferences. It's going to be on population genetics. It's going to be with the authors, Dr. Ed Burns and Harry Oster, mentioned in the slide, are two of the people that ran a wonderful study. And we also hope to have Carl Skorecki, who's a Frum scientist, who's the person who published the first Cohen gene paper. A number of years ago. But what is population genetics? Population genetics is a different field of study. It's not clinically applied genetics. It's taking populations, studying their genes, and isolating commonalities. So what Harry Oster and Ed Burns did is they took a wide variety of Jews throughout the world and did a very detailed genetic analysis on these Jews and found out that there is a significant percentage of commonality amongst Jews of all shapes and sizes throughout the world, which again is some kind of testimony to the fact that that we derive from a common source. We obviously don't need this validation. We as Torah observant Jews with our Emunah and Bitachon know that, believe that. We don't need the genetic proof, but it is interesting research nonetheless. And on that vein, there's another interesting tangent in population genetics. And I mention this because it's a little bit relevant. The Manos Levi says in Esther that when Mordechai wouldn't bow down, wouldn't be korei mishtachavet to Haman, it says ki amar lo. I don't remember the exact lashon. Ki amar lo ki hu Yehudi. Those of you Bali Kriya will correct me. Ki gila masher hu Yehudi. So the classic interpretation is, you know, tell him that I'm a Jew and I don't bow down because I'm a Jew. But the Manos Levi has a different interpretation. He says that there was a historical time before the Megillas Esther where Mordechai and Haman were generals in different battles, and Haman needed a certain amount of assistance, so he begged Mordechai for assistance. Mordechai said, that's fine, as long as you become my Eved Kenani. So Haman became the Eved Kenani of Mordechai. So So there is some status. You guys know more about this than I do. About the Eved Kanani is at least some partial yadus for an Eved Kanani. So when he says Kigid Lahem Kihu Yudi, he says tell Haman, remind him that he is actually a Jew and he shouldn't be asking me to bow down to him. So in that vein, you have this area of research. Taliban and Al-Qaeda may be descended from Jews. The ethnic group at the heart of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Pakistan may have descended from their Jewish enemy, according to researchers in India. Experts at Mumbai's National Institute of Immunohematology believe Pashtuns could be one of the 10 lost tribes of Israel. Now talk about changing the political history. Imagine if these guys ended up being one of the 10 lost tribes. Now, you may ask me also, why on earth would anybody do this kind of research? Not exactly sure on that one. So we have, I apologize, I have to run at 2:30 because I have to be at the hospital, so I'll try and cover as much as I can in the time we have allotted today. Let's spend a few minutes on another really extraordinary frontier, and that's the field of stem cell research. And I'm sure, you're all familiar with the concept of stem cell research. You may not be so familiar with the details of stem cell research. But stem cell research came on the scene a decade or so ago and was hailed to be one of the most extraordinary advances in the history of medicine, thought to have the potential to cure many human diseases, affect the lives of millions of people with the advances in stem cell research. Some of these have come to fruition, many have not, and the cogwheels of research do take time as they navigate their ways through animal research into human research. But the basic notion is that when the embryo is fertilized at a stage later than the stage of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, at the blastocyst stage, there is a small group of cells called embryonic stem cells. These embryonic stem cells, at this stage of gestation, each one of them can theoretically become every single organ system in the body. So each one of these cells could be a kidney cell, a living, this is the human blastocyst, and these are the stem cells. Each one of these stem cells could become a heart, liver, lungs, kidneys, every imaginable part of the organ. The field of embryology is the evolution of these cells to become different organ systems within the body, and I always say, to study embryology and to see this little cell become the people sitting in this room and not to believe HaKadosh Baruch Hu is divining this process, to me is a mind-boggling notion. To me it's patently obvious. You can't be a disbeliever when you study the field of embryology. But the belief is that the harvesting these stem cells and directing them to produce different cell lines can possibly treat diseases like Parkinson's, like heart disease, like diabetes. And in fact, Christopher Reeves, who lobbied at the end of his life before he died last year for advances in stem cell research in spinal cord disease, and now he might be seeing the fruits of some of his labor. And in fact, in a study with rats last year, a week after test rats with 100% walking ability suffered neck spinal cord injuries, some received the stem cell treatment. The walking ability of those that didn't degrade to 38%. Treated rats' ability, however, was restored to 97% walking ability. And just this past month, the very first human subject enrolled in a stem cell research trial for spinal cord injury was entered into the study. So we will see if there is a possibility for the regeneration of the spinal cord with stem cell research, which is quite extraordinary. The basic halachic issues, I'll just synopsize these. The basic halachic issues at the beginning of this discussion were, what is the halachic status of the human embryo? So we know, for example, the Catholic Church says the human embryo has the status of the nefesh, and you're guilty of homicide if you destroy the human embryo, even if the embryo is sitting in the laboratory. But Lamaisa, the halachic discussions revolved around the status of the human embryo outside the body, and the consensus is pretty much clear. Even in utero, what is the status of the fetus? The fetus does not have a status of a full nefesh in utero. It's only after birth that the fetus has a full status of a human being in the eyes of halacha that you could be culpable of homicide and sentenced to death in, by a Beis Din. But before that, now, so all the more so, with an embryo sitting in the laboratory, does not have a status of human life. Here you have just one of a number of poskim, Rav Vosner, who writes that that for sure the this embryo sitting in the laboratory does not have a status of nefesh, and many, many poskim allow for the harvesting of embryonic stem cells for the purpose of stem cell research. Here you have Rav Levi Yitzchak Halperin, who writes, Be'im heim yutarim l'chalutin, if these embryos that are sitting in the laboratory that are not being used for reproductive purposes, that were originally harvested for fertility treatments, omdim l'hashmada, and they're destined for destruction, min ha'ra'ui la'asos bohem shimush l'tzorech refu'i chiyuni sh'latzos nefashos minstrel b'kfuf l'pikuach l'chatzim l'smach, which means that yes, it is permitted, maybe even encouraged, to take these embryos that would otherwise be discarded and use them for the purpose of research, which might actually save human lives. And here's just a smattering of some articles on the topic. But the developments have proceeded in the following way. So while the entire discussion revolves around the status of the human embryo, let me read that for those of you who can't read that. It says, we're doing our best, Mr. Johnson. You have to remember that stem cell research is still in its infancy. This little foot on top of the head. The entire discussion revolved around the embryo because in order to harvest these golden stem cells, you have to destroy the human embryo. So the question is the embryo life? Is it not life? Are you killing life? Still remains discussion. But now, they can harvest, they can produce embryonic stem cells or find them in other places without having to destroy the human embryo. So they can extract them from the umbilical cord blood, for example. And here, another one of my favorite cartoons, one stem cell, the mother stem cell, talking to the baby stem cell. Says, you want to be a brain cell? You have to study. You goof off, you'll end up in the rectum. But this research is really quite extraordinary research. And this research is taking regular cells, not embryonic cells, not the human embryo, taking a skin cell and injecting it with certain enzymes that take over the machinery of that cell that can produce embryonic-like stem cells, obviating the need to even touch the human embryo. So if that becomes a possibility, that'll basically take this entire chapter of halachic discussions on stem cell research, excise it from the contemporary halacha curriculum, and put it into the medical history curriculum. And that may happen in short order. This is one of the most recent developments in stem cells. Stem cells used to fight women's brain tumor. They just, this past few weeks, injected stem cells directly into the brain of a woman in a magnificent, elegant experiment where they are giving her medications by mouth and intravenously, which will actually interact with the stem cells that were injected into the brain and target specifically the tumor cells without targeting the innate brain tissue and without destroying the natural brain tissue. We'll see how that evolves with time. Just going to see what we should do in our brief few moments. Let me mention one slide here, and then we'll talk about coma and persistent vegetative state, and we'll close. So the landscape that we mentioned organ donation one or two times in the course of our lecture, Derech Agav, the landscape of organ transplants in the 20th century, wherein organ transplantation began, revolved around the transplantation of vital organs. A vital organ is an organ needed for preservation of life. And that's where it pretty much stands now. Kidneys, livers, lungs, hearts. You can't survive with any of these. And the poskim discussed, you know, is it mutter for the recipient to receive it because it's a risky procedure and they have to take medications which are very dangerous for the rest of their lives? And the basic answer was because bikuach nefesh for the recipient, they can't survive without these vital organs. We're going to be mutter them to A, undergo the procedure, B, take the medications for the rest of their lives. Then there's shilas about donating. So can you be a live kidney donor? And that child has been asked and answered, and all the poskim can see are in agreement that you're allowed to be a kidney donor. Avad Yosef says it might even be mechuyev to be a kidney donor. But everybody agrees now, you know, 20 years, 30 years after transplantation began, that you're allowed to be a kidney donor. What remains a debate is donation after death, and that's cadaveric donation. And what's considered death, if you're brain dead or not brain dead, you can ask Rabbi Tendler next week. Of course, if you ask him at the beginning of this year, you probably won't hear too much else for the rest of the year, for the rest of the time. But it remains a major debate amongst the Gedolei HaPoskim, with major poskim saying that brain death is considered death and others not, and that impacts on the debate. But what's the new frontier here? New frontier is now shifting into non-vital organ transplants, transplanting organs that you don't need for the preservation of life. So transplanting hands. There have been 40 cases of hand transplants over the past 5-10 years. What are the halachic shailos with that? Can someone undergo that procedure for something which he doesn't need to survive? The uterus can be transplanted. There's been one case of a uterus transplantation. We talked about issues from that 1907 case. So what about if a woman has a transplanted uterus that a woman gave birth to somebody already with that uterus, but now she never had a child and now has her first child with that transplanted uterus? Do you do a pidyon haben on that, or do you not do a pidyon haben on that? There's been a successful case of larynx transplant, somebody without a voice box. So if you transplant a female larynx into a male patient, is that considered kol isha? These are serious problems, guys. But joking aside, this is a whole new frontier of transplantation, which is going to generate shilas about the permissibility of undergoing procedures which are not absolutely for pikuach nefesh, which are more for enhancement, and donation issues. Is it permitted to donate some of these things while you're alive, like to donate a uterus, for example, and these kinds of shilas. And finally, the issue of end-of-life issues. A really interesting frontier, which is going to clearly impact on the treatment of patients at end-of-life and end-of-life shilas that you're going to be getting. And here we have an article from in February of the New England Journal of Medicine, willful modulation of brain activity and disorders of consciousness. Here's the synopsis of the research. It has generally been believed that people who are in persistent vegetative state, like Terry Schiavo, Karen Ann Quinlan, and others, have no consciousness, no ability to interact with their environment. So they put this to the test. They took a number of patients in a persistent vegetative state, and they subjected them to a test that's called a functional MRI. Functional MRI, as opposed to a CAT scan or an MRI, which is a static picture, like taking a photograph, it's a movie of the brain, a movie of the active brain. And they had a group of controls, and they asked them a number of questions, and they had a group of persistent vegetative patients that had been vegetative for years with no perceived ability to interact with their environment whatsoever. And they asked them questions. They said, imagine yourself, the control volunteers were sitting, not doing any action. They said, imagine yourself playing tennis, and the frontal cortex of the brain would light up. Imagine yourself walking through your room at home, and the certain parts of the brain would light up. So then they went to these patients who were in persistent vegetative state, and they asked them the exact same questions. So majority of the patients had no function whatsoever, no light up in the brain whatsoever, but a small percentage of patients actually had light up in the brain exactly as their controlled volunteers did. So here you have, of 54 patients, it's not really such a small number, of the 54 patients enrolled in the study, 5 were able to willfully modulate their brain activity, which means when asked the question, they had brain response, which means they understood the question and they were conscious, just not perceptibly conscious, which is a frightening concept. And you had one patient here who was comatose for 23 years. 23 years. And the family was unaware of any perceptible ability for him to understand, and he saw everything that was going on around the bedside. And now with technology, with computer technology, the family's able to communicate with him. His eyes can focus on computer screens, and he can actually create words and effectively communicate with his family. What are the halachic ramifications? The halachic ramifications are the permissibility of withholding care is predicated on pain perception. So there's an interesting machlokas between Rav Moshe and Rav Yashiv. Rav Moshe holds, you're allowed to withhold certain treatments because the patient is in pain. And he says even a comatose patient's in pain, existential pain, and the license to withhold certain treatments applies to a comatose patient. But Rav Yashiv says no. Rav Yashiv says, Raki macholas sovel miyasurim kashim. Then you can say shei v'al tase. V'lachein, but if a person is completely comatose, and he may not be suffering at all because he's comatose, he doesn't perceive pain. The irony is that the comatose patient, you have to treat more aggressively because he's not perceiving any pain, so you don't have a license to withhold the treatment. So obviously this new research would have very significant impact on that halachic debate. So in conclusion, we cited Thomas Jefferson at the beginning. We'll cite another American founder in the end. The progress of human knowledge will be rapid, and discoveries made of which we have at present no conception. Benjamin Franklin said in 1793, "Since I begin to be almost sorry I was born so soon, since I cannot have the happiness of knowing what will be known 100 years hence." And that was Benjamin Franklin then. Imagine today, with things proceeding so rapidly. But the importance is, for us, as here in this institution, is that these are things that we have to address. Now, the Gedolei HaPoskim are addressing many of them today, but you guys will be addressing some of these in the future, and we've had an opportunity today to at least address a handful of the things which you may be discussing in the near future. And I thank you very much for allowing me to be here. And if you guys have any questions, either now or in the future, my email address is there. Feel free to contact me. And Chag Sameach to you all.
Thank you so much.